and welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 30th of May 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week. It's beautiful weather outside, beautiful summer's weather, and I am inside recording once again for you, the listeners, and I am joined today by my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? How's life treating you?
Life's treating me very well at the moment. I've become a grandfather again for the sixth time over the last day or so, which is extremely good. And so from a sort of a family perspective, things are proceeding very well. And as you say, we're enjoying good summer weather at the moment, which can't be bad.
You must be feeling very proud of yourself. I mean, it's great to be grandparents, I guess, and see your children and then your grandchildren as well, and know that all of those have been created by you and your wife, and the generations are going to continue, and you're doing your duty for all the generations that come before. And I think you never see such a happy smile as a smile on a grandmother's face when she's got her grandchildren there. You know, you never see that on a feminist that didn't actually produce children and devoted her entire life to working for a stranger for wages instead of loving her husband and producing children. Although, I mean, you say you've got six grandchildren. I mean, years ago, people would have 10 or 12 children and then about 100 grandchildren. But that's still good going, Max. And I guess you probably haven't had much time to look at the news this week. Have you managed to pick anything out that's been going on in Britain that we could start with?
Well, the one thing that we could have a look at, and this is something that has occasionally featured prominently, the use of imperial measures versus metric measures, this kind of issue. A lot of people have got it into their head that that we're only using metric measures because of our past membership of the European Union. But in fact, we were moving towards a situation where we would be using metric measures long before we joined the European Union. And despite the fact that people feel very strongly about it, I think the fact that Boris Johnson has made a pronouncement that as one of the Brexit bonuses that we're going to enjoy as a result of coming out of the European Union is that we can now return to using metric measures in commerce. And business, which I think is a bit of a distraction, really, because I think to a great extent it's a bit of a non-issue. I mean, just to give you a little bit of history of this sort of thing, there was a move towards the standardization of measures that were used internationally, particularly in science and also in trade. And this began in 1856, where Britain joined the Organization for International Metrology, which is called the IOML. It's obviously its formal title is in a different language to ours. In joining this organization, we agreed to move towards a single system of measures in order to, as I say, promote international trade and to promote scientific inquiry between nations. Then we moved to from imperial weights to metric weights in 1965. We then moved to decimalisation of currency in 1971, which a lot of people objected to at the time, and has been a sort of was a thorn in the side of governments for couple of decades or so after that. But then we joined the European Union in 1973. And the thing is that schools now, and schools have for several decades, taught the metric system. And so if we were to just return to imperial measures, and to no longer measure things in the metric way, that would tend to cause problems for those people who've been raised with centimeters and meters and with liters, as opposed to feet and inches and gallons and pints. my perception of it is that the younger somebody is, the more inclined they are going to be to use metric measures. But then as they get older, they then sort of gradually, because of the common usage of, still of imperial measures by older people, they become accustomed to using imperial measures and thinking in imperial measures for certain things, but not for other things. And so, for example, if you were going to buy yourself a jacket in a shop, you wouldn't go into the shop and ask for a 96.52 centimeter chest jacket. You would go into the shop and you'd ask for a 38 inch jacket, wouldn't you? And so we are in a situation where we are currently operating both systems side by side. You know, if you buy a pair of trousers, then it's a perhaps a 30-inch waist and a 32-inch inside leg. Nobody uses the metric measures for things of that sort. But for shoe sizes, you can go into a shop and ask for a shoe size 11, for example, in English shoe sizes, or you can ask go in and ask for a shoe size 45 in a metric size, and they will both be the same size shoe. And so for certain things, you can use either. But other things, we tend as we become accustomed to just to still using the imperial measures. And for certain things, particularly scientific measurements and particularly very small measures, I think particularly people prefer to use the metric measures. And I think really we should just leave it as it is, because I think criminalizing the selling of something in imperial measures was the mistake that the European Union made. They should have just said you can carry on using both if you want to, because I think that that there will be a gravitation towards a single system to be used eventually, and I think that gravitation will probably be in favor of metric measures ultimately, because that's what's being taught to the young and has been taught to most of our young. And most of the world uses metric measures. And if we are going to be, as Boris Johnson states, a global nation, then we really ought to be conducting our business with the most common system of weights and measures.
Well, I can imagine that the use of the word imperial as well would cause trouble nowadays with its colonial connotations, but using feet and inches, I mean, that goes back hundreds of years, thousands of years. In fact, they had the pyramid inch going back to when they built the pyramids. And centimeters and meters, that's all very modern. And I think the imperial measures were easier to use for people that weren't mathematicians, because it was all quarters, eighths, sixteenths, splitting something down. I think that was more easier to use if you were actually building something, rather than if you were sort of planning something out mathematically to plan with blueprints and what have you. But before we had access to pen, paper, computers, it would have been so much easier just using quarter of something, half of something, sixteenth of something, which seems to be how the imperial measures are set up. And it has introduced confusion between the two, trying to work out what's what. And as you say, there's no uniformity over it, but I don't really see what it has to do with Brexit. So you think it's just Boris Johnson trying to sell Brexit and cashing in on people's resentment of having to move to metric? I mean, it's a long time since I heard people actually complaining about it, so it's taken them years to try and break free of it. Wasn't there something called the metric martyrs or something a few years back?
There were metric martyrs. These were tradespeople who continued to sell fruit markets in imperial measures, and so you'd go and you'd buy £2 of apples or something like that, and this was the foolish thing that the European Union did, and it did cause a lot of people to think less of the European Union because they did insist on this, because it was one of the facets of the kind of micromanagement and the totalitarian tendency within the European Union to say, oh, you cannot sell. You know, if somebody wants to buy apples in pounds and ounces because they don't understand metric measures, and somebody's prepared to sell them apples in pounds and ounces because they want to pander to the to the requirements of the customer, then why shouldn't it be allowed? You know, making it illegal to do that, and so these metric martyrs then were sort of carted off to Britain, was the silly thing that the European Union did. And of course, a foot was, roughly speaking, the length of a man's foot, and that's how, you know, the measure of a foot came about. And it's quite easy if you're out and somebody says to you, oh, can you measure out a 10-foot by 10-foot plot? You can then, by walking and placing your heel in front of your toe, your heel in front of your toe, your heel in front of your toe, you can walk 10 paces like that and measure out a square that would be roughly 10 feet by 10 feet, you know, give or take a very small margin of error. And as far as English shoe sizes were concerned, English shoe sizes were the length of a barley seed. It was an inch was 3 barley seeds laid end to end, which sounds like quite a strange thing. And you think, well, barley seeds are going to be different sizes. But actually, if you get a big pot of barley seeds and you lay them out, 3 of them end to end, and you measure them, they are, as near as makes no difference, an inch long when you've got 3 of them set out like that. But if somebody said to you, how tall is somebody, you might say, oh, well, they're 6 foot tall. But if you said how tall is somebody, and they said, oh, he's 1.82 meters, then 1.82 meters doesn't necessarily make 6 feet sort of spring to mind. And and particularly with things like measures of liquid, for example, where you talk about miles per gallon for a car. Now, if somebody turns around to you and says, oh, my car does 12.75 kilometers to the litre, is that good fuel consumption, or is that not good fuel consumption? Would you know? Whereas if somebody turned around and said, actually, my car does 30 miles to the gallon, which is the same as 12.75 kilometers to the litre, then you'd have some idea as to whether or not that was good miles per gallon. But the other sort of complication of all of this is that there are only 2 countries left in the world, apparently, that still use imperial measures, one of which is the United States of America, and the other one is Myanmar, which used to be Burma in old money. Now, as far as the USA is concerned, though, the USA's imperial measures are actually slightly different to what were the UK's imperial measures. So where I said to you just a minute ago that 12.75 kilometres to the litre was the same as 30 miles per gallon, that was 30 United States miles per gallon. Whereas if you were looking at imperial miles per gallon, then 30 imperial miles per gallon would be equivalent to 10.62 kilometres per litre. And so this kind of return to imperial isn't really going to help us in terms of trade with the United States, because the United States measures are slightly different to ours. And it's going to make trade, particularly if a British manufacturer was trying to sell products to any other country in the world, it's going to just make it more difficult if we're advertising our product as being in imperial measures. And so I think that as far as Boris allowing us to use imperial measures again is concerned, I think it's more a little bit of flag waving. It's something akin to also the fact that Boris Johnson has also apparently said that now our pubs are going to have the crown on the side of our beer glasses, just to show that it is a British imperial pint. I think this is all just a little bit of distraction associated with the Queen's Jubilee, which is intended just basically to distract people's attention from this sort of Partygate situation, and the fact that the economy is starting to downturn as a result of all of the borrowing that's been taking place in order for us to recover from the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, the cost of living is massively increasing, isn't it? I mean, they're talking like it could go up 10% with the inflation. So they're giving us two bank holidays we've got coming up for the Queen's Jubilee. I mean, what is that, 50 years or 75 years that she's actually been queen for. I mean, that's
I think it's
70 years. I mean, that's quite an achievement, isn't it, really? I mean, she must be the longest reigning monarch that we've ever had. So good on her for that. It's just a shame that she doesn't speak up for the indigenous British people. But I guess since the British Empire, she's really sort of seen herself as a figurehead for all the different peoples that were involved in that empire. Do you know if the imperial name for the style of measurement, does that actually come from the British Empire or does it come from somewhere else? Do you know?
I think it's... the imperial measures were the measures that were used in Britain. And when we created the empire, we just insisted that the empire used our system of measures. And so it became known as the imperial system of measurement.
So that is so actually where it came from then.
Yeah, it is directly derived from imperial.
Yeah. So, of course, the Americans had to change it and have a different version.
Well, they've got a different version. I mean, this was more brought home to me, to be quite honest, when I owned an American motorcycle a few years back. And I then needed to go and buy a whole new set of spanners because I'd originally, when I was a boy and I messed around on motorbikes, I had imperial spanners. But then as we transitioned to having the metric measures. I've now got sort of spanners that are all in millimeters. But then when I bought this American motorcycle, I had to go and buy a completely new set of spanners that were neither the same as the British Imperial ones because the American ones were all slightly different. And the threads, the profile of the threads on screws and nuts and bolts and things are all different in America to what they were as far as the UK imperial threads, etc. And so switching, if we were to switch back in any sort of great, in any extensive way to using imperial measures, it would be a trip, it would be a nostalgia fest rather than it being something that would actually help us with trade, because obviously it wouldn't help us with trade with America very much. I doubt that we do a tremendous amount of trade with Myanmar, but it would just create greater confusion with regard to trading with the rest of the world.
Yeah, universal measurement. I mean, obviously, it's quite important, isn't it? You've got the confusion there. You've got metric, and then you've got two different types of imperial measurement. You can see that George Stephenson did really well to get a universal gauge for the railways that it was going to be the same gauge wherever it was. But the idea of actually banning people from selling what they want in the measurement that they want to somebody that wants that measurement, I mean, that just sounds absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we think the speech laws are ridiculous, but imagine, you know, not being allowed to buy a certain measurement that you want. So at least that's good that they're changing that law, but they're still sticking with their free speech laws, the ridiculous free speech laws that are preventing comedians from actually telling funny jokes at the moment. When you think our oldest joke is the Englishman, the Scotsman and the Irishman joke, which is based on different ethnicities, and that is the whole point of the joke, the fact that they're making laws to outlaw people from making jokes about any minorities is that really does hit at British tradition, I think. And I bring this up because Ricky Gervais is in the news at the moment for a new comedy set that he's produced, which has really upset people on the left. And apparently the British government could be trying to make sets like that illegal, despite the fact that the appeals court have said that this is something they should not be doing. And I just came across this news article which came out this weekend that refers to it. They say plans to encourage more people to complain to police about anti-trans hate crimes could criminalise comedians such as Ricky Gervais. The Home Office is in the process of drawing up a new hate crimes strategy that aims to increase the reporting of all forms of hate crime, including those relating to gender identity. And of course, we know that, you know, a lot of the time here, there's nothing hateful involved in this. It just may be critical of one of these minority groups, or it may be pointing out statistics about some of these minority groups. And you get accused of a hate crime for talking about anything negative involved with that group, it, despite there being no hate intended, and despite it not being something that's going to make anybody hate the particular group or not. I mean, we talk about these things because we want to change government policy, and you cannot change government policy unless you point out the negative effects that the government policy is having. Obviously, I believe the whole concept of hate crimes is to distract from the fact that we're criticising government policy and pretend that we're criticising these groups, because nothing positive is going to be gained from just criticising a group or harassing a group. It's the government policy that needs to be changed. So rather than scaling back on these laws and these guidelines, they seem to be increasing them. As I say, there was actually a court ruling last year which said that they shouldn't be doing this. The plans are being developed despite a court ruling last year which ordered police to stop recording gender-critical views as non-crime hate incidents, which are declarations of wrongdoing added to someone's criminal record. Last night, Sarah Phillimore, a barrister from the Fair Cop campaign group, said that ministers' plans ignored the appeal court ruling and could put the police on the wrong side of the law. She said these plans suggest either that the government is not paying attention or that they have contempt for the Court of Appeal. Either way, it is astonishing that legislators are planning to expand the discredited and unlawful practice of recording non-crime hate incidents. Following Fair Cop's win in the Court of Appeal in December, the College of Policing promised to publish revised hate crime guidance by the end of May this year, and we are still waiting. Police forces that record complaints against comedians or any other lawful speech as non-crime hate incidents will be piling illegality upon illegality. They will then find themselves in court with no legitimate defence. This quixotic strategy oozes arrogance, as if the law does not apply if you are fighting for the, quote, right side of history. But how can you be on the right side of history if you are repeatedly on the wrong side of the law? And this is referring to Harry something or other his name was, that was in court last year. He was an ex-police officer himself, and the police went round and they knocked on his door and they said, we need to check your thinking. And it was to do with a tweet where he said that men are men, women are women, or words to that effect. And they recorded what he said, and they said that we're putting it in as a non-crime hate incident. And he took the police to court over this and said that the police should only be investigating crimes. They shouldn't be investigating people's opinions and recording them as hate incidents. And the Court of Appeal said that he was correct, and that the policing guidance needed to be changed. And the government have completely ignored this, and they're saying we want more reports of people with differing opinions to what the government has. And as I say, this is all coming out at the same time as Ricky Gervais has come out with a new comedy set. The move comes after Gervais, creator of The Office, angered Twitter's woke brigade following the broadcast of his new Netflix special Supernature, which mocks cancel culture with jokes about trans people, Hitler and AIDS. And of course, they're all taboo subjects. So, and comedy has always been about broaching taboo subjects and joking about them and getting people to talk about them. I mean, if you make a joke about something that people don't really talk about, it gets them talking about it. I mean, that's the point of it. The comic 60 kicks off the show by describing comedy to the audience as basically a bloke talking before deliberately failing to recall any funny female comedians. And in one skit, he says the worst thing you can say today is women don't have penises, right? The show has sparked a backlash from LGBT groups and has seen Gervais accused of hate crimes. How can it be a hate crime when the audience is falling about with laughter? Then the audience is not shouting, kill the trannies, you know, they're just rolling about in fits of laughter. It's not hate. Under the new strategy being developed by the government, members of the public could be allowed to register an official complaint about his routine. A Home Office spokesperson said these claims are completely wrong. There are no plans to expand recording of non-crime hate incidents, nor will we criminalise comedians or introduce a complaint scheme. Free speech is a fundamental right and we will always protect it. Our approach will ensure the police are focusing their resources on serious and harmful hate crimes, such as violent assaults and attacks on places of worship. If only they would. I've never heard of them doing that, though. All the resources are being spent on going after people saying things on Twitter, saying things on Facebook, saying things on podcasts, saying things on streams. I can't recall any serious or violent assaults or attacks on places of worship which have been foiled by the police, really. In the last couple of years, we've had these court cases against people for being members of National Action, the proscribed terrorist organization. But as far as violent assaults and attacks on places of worship, they really just don't happen. All we read about is attacks on free speech. We've got this new online harms bill, which is coming up, where they are saying even speech which is not illegal, speech which doesn't actually break the Public Order Act, is not incitement to hate. They want companies to remove it, and it's going to be one of the MPs, I think the Secretary of State or something, she can just say, we want this banned and you have to remove it, even though it's completely legal. So when they say here that there are no plans to expand this and we're just going to concentrate on serious and harmful hate crimes, they've already done the opposite of that. They've already done the opposite of that. That's probably what this is referring to. What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, the thing I wanted to just sort of say is that, you know, we've got Ricky Gervais, who is now saying that comedy is under a serious threat from woke censorship. We've had in the past John Cleese making the same point, and we've also recently had Jimmy Carr making the same point. And the thing that they try and point out is that humour very often revolves around poking fun at people and poking fun at people's beliefs, the things that people do that are absurd. When you poke fun at people, then there is always a risk that they might take offence at that. But in poking fun, it doesn't mean that the comedian actually believes literally the thing that they're saying. And so if a comedian makes a joke about somebody who is trans, for example, it doesn't mean that they want everybody to go out and start beating up trans people. It just means that they said something that was funny in the moment. Everybody knows it's fun. It's only intended to be fun, and so people laugh at it. But the audiences don't all get up from watching a comedian march out into the street and start hunting down people who are of a different ethnicity or people who are trans or people who are homosexual or whatever and beating them all up. You know, people will go and watch a comedian and they'll laugh about the funny side of things. And very often the jokes, and more often than not, the jokes nowadays where a joke is being made by somebody from an ethnic group about people of another ethnic group, the jokes and the fun poking is far more often nowadays where the person is a member of a minority group, not necessarily an ethnic group, but perhaps a sexual orientation group or whatever, who are poking fun at white people. And it wasn't so long ago, probably only about within the last year, I can't remember exactly when the date was, where there was a lady from an ethnic minority. She was a comedian who was on television who made a humorous aside about killing Whitey. Everybody on that particular program thought that was hilariously funny. In all seriousness, I don't think she actually meant that she wanted black people to go out and start killing white people as a result of their sort of perception that they've been discriminated against in the past. And as far as I'm aware, nobody took her up on that and went charging out and attacking white people. So authorities in this country didn't decide to prosecute her over it because the authorities also realized that it was just humor. She'd be saying something that was a funny aside, in the same way that Ricky Gervais, John Cleese, and Jimmy Carr all make funny asides, where they very often are using irony to say something that they don't actually believe, but which is funny. Because their job is to say things that are funny to make people laugh, and that they shouldn't be inhibited and prevented from being able to perform in the way that they want because of silly woke censorship.
Well, it's good that mainstream comedians are speaking up about this, because there's been so many alternative comedians or amateur streamers, people that aren't on television, that have fallen foul of this law. I mean, people that have made funny memes that have ended up in prison, people that have sung funny songs that ended up in prison. We had Kank Dankula and he had his pug dog, and his pug dog raised his arm in a Hitler salute. And I mean, that was prosecuted as a crime. So I'm glad to see that we have these mainstream comedians that are speaking up about it. I think comedy, I think the very reason why we laugh, I think there's an evolutionary aspect to it, a group protection aspect with it, because I think it reinforces the in-group. You see something in the out-group that is different to the in-group. You make a joke about it, everybody laughs, and it gets reinforced that there's, you know, there's these other groups out there, and you have the same sense of humor with your own group. And I think that's the group evolutionary psychological aspect to humor, the reason why we actually have humor. It protects the group, it increases the sense of union between the group, because you all have the same sense of humor, and you're laughing at something that's different in this other group. And you can see that, as I say, with the Englishman, the Scotsman, the Irishman jokes. You can see it in jokes about the French, showing the French and they eat their frog's legs and their snails, and we make jokes about that, and it enforces the group bonding between our group, and it also defines the other. So I think that's the very reason why we have humour in the first place. And I think that's why we find these differences funny. It's the differences between us and others that are so often, they are the centre point of the joke. And then to try and introduce this sort of legislation into it and say that people are inciting hate when they're just trying to make people laugh. I mean, maybe this could be the straw that breaks the camel's back, especially if it's starting to get these mainstream comedians involved. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, I think that perhaps there is, perhaps the tide is beginning to turn in terms of woke censorship. It will be good if that is the case, because it will mean that comedians won't feel inhibited when they're actually performing, because a lot of a lot of comedians like to perform stand up live, and if you're delivering stand up live, then it's as any comedian will tell you, it's timing that makes a joke funny. And if you've got to hesitate to think, oh crikey, is what I'm about to say going to get me into trouble, then your timing is going to be off, and you won't be as funny as you would have been otherwise. And so it's a great shame that we do have, and we have had particularly in recent decades, this creeping censorship and this intention that there can only be one point of view, the woke point of view, and hopefully we can turn the tide, and it would be good if these famous comedians could lead us in that respect, in a reversal of what's been going on in recent times.
So much of comedy up until now, it's all just been left leaning, and now when they're, so you know, when it was Maggie Thatcher that was in power, it was the people that were in power that they were mocking. But since it's been like left wing people in power all these years, it's just not funny anymore. So yeah, I'm very glad to see that Ricky Gervais is poking fun at some of these sacred cows, and I'd like to see more comedians doing it as well. Well, shall we move into our Greatest Britons for this week then, Max?
Yes, that'd be good.
We have a new Greatest Briton. We have picked Sir Francis Drake for this week. It'll probably be two or three episodes where we take a look at this great man, this great Briton. Sir Francis Drake was an English explorer, a sea captain, a privateer, a slave trader, and we'll get more into that, just whether he was a slave trader or not, a naval officer, and a politician. And we're probably well aware of what each of those are, apart from possibly privateer. And a privateer is a private person or ship that engages in maritime warfare under a commission of war. Since robbery under arms was a common aspect of seaborne trade until the early 19th century, all merchant ships carried arms. A sovereign or delegated authority issued commissions, also referred to as a letter of marque, during wartime. The commission empowered the holder to carry on all forms of hostility permissible at sea by the usages of war. This included attacking foreign vessels and taking them as prizes, and taking prize crews as prisoners for exchange. Captured ships were subject to condemnation and sale under prize law, with the proceeds divided by percentage between the privateer's sponsors, ship owners, captains and crew, and a percentage share usually went to the issuer of the commission, i.e. the sovereign. So basically they were legalized pirates. If a country was at war with another country, or a country was getting on the verge of declaring war, they, before they would actually declare war, they might do this. They might issue letters of marque to the ships and the vessels that wanted them. And if they saw a vessel that was at sea by the enemy power, then they could take that vessel, and they would be entitled to half of everything that they could get from selling that vessel. And they also didn't mistreat the people that were on these vessels, as we'll see as we get further on, because Sir Francis Drake was looked at as if he was a pirate by the Spanish, but he was looked at as a great hero by the British because he was this this privateer. And we're going to get into that before we get into his circumnavigation as well. Max, have you got anything you'd like to say on privateers or anything about Sir Francis Drake?
Well, only that Sir Francis Drake was, when I was a schoolboy, was lionized as one of the greatest Britons, a great sailor, and it's a great shame that the pursuit of glory, I suppose, is now sort of regarded as being such an awful thing, because Sir Francis Drake was the sort of person who could see that the world was opening up to people who were exploring, and that there were possibilities created. If you explored enough of the world, you would find situations where it was possible for you to make lots of money and to become a very wealthy person. It was a way in which lots of people of fairly humble origins made fortunes for themselves. And it wasn't just us that did it. It was other countries that were doing it as well. And so there was a period of kind of free for all. And Francis Drake was just regarded as one of the people who firstly became very wealthy from doing that kind of thing, but also was very famous for defeating the Spanish Armada and saving Britain from invasion by the Spanish.
He did all sorts of fantastic things. The 16th century, the world was just starting to open up. You could have lots of adventures if you were a young man in the 16th century. And he didn't start off from the aristocracy either. Well, Drake is best known for his circumnavigation of the world in a single expedition from 1577 to 1580. And this included his incursion into the Pacific Ocean, which was until then an area of exclusive Spanish interest. And his claim to New Albion for England, an area in what is now the US state of California. His expedition inaugurated an era of conflict with the Spanish on the western coast of the Americas, an area that had previously been largely unexplored by Western shipping. Elizabeth I awarded Drake a knighthood in 1581, which he received on the Golden Hind in Deptford. In the same year, he was appointed the Mayor of Plymouth. As a vice admiral, he was second in command of the English fleet in the victorious battle against the Spanish Armada in 1588. After unsuccessfully attacking San Juan, Puerto Rico, he died of dysentery in January 1596. Drake's exploits made him a hero to the English, but his privateering led the Spanish to brand him a pirate, known to them as El Drac. King Philip II of Spain allegedly offered a reward of 20,000 ducats for his capture or death, which is equivalent to around £6 million in 2015. So he was very important to Spain. Spain was a huge country at this time, and England was fairly small. This was before the British Empire. We were talking about Elizabeth I in our last episode of Greatest Britons. And Sir Francis Drake formed a part of that. And we learned there a little bit about the problems that we had with Spain. But Spain had a huge empire. And really, it spread itself too thin. All the brightest and the best of the Spaniards went off empire building. And they really didn't leave that many left at home. The same happened to Portugal. Portugal had a huge, great empire at one time in the past as well. And now if you look at Spain and Portugal, they're really not that important in the scheme of things. And a lot of it was that their best DNA, their best genes actually left the country. But I guess it's all ups and downs. We had our British Empire for a couple of hundred years, and now we're back to being just a little island again. Got any comments on this, Max, at all?
One of the things that I believe affected Spain, and it may be that it affected Portugal in the same way, was that as part of their conquest of Central America, they the conquistadors were in battle with I think it was the Incas or whatever, but I'm not quite sure which country it is in today, but in part of South America around Peru, there is the largest gold mine that there has ever been. Is it a gold mine or a silver mine? I'm sort of recounting this from memory, but so it may have been silver actually. But there was the largest mine of its sort of precious metal in the world, and the Spanish just kept sending their galleons over there, and they were then just loading them up with coins that they were minting with this precious metal that they were mining there, and sailing it back to Europe. And then, of course, they then had massive spending power and were able to buy weaponry, were able to buy machinery, and so the Spanish Empire thrived because it had this constant supply of almost unlimited supply of gold, literally a license to mint money, and that appears to have only been a temporary advantage for them.
Yeah, well, it would appear that that's really when they fell out with Britain, that was their weak spot, was that they were carrying all this bullion over from South America in their ships. And obviously, we're pretty good at sea, being the British. We've had our navy since Alfred the Great. We're known for our sea power, basically. And Sir Francis Drake was taking a portion of that, the gold and the silver as it was coming back, because we were almost at war with them before we actually entered into the hot war. This is what we were doing. It actually sort of reminds me a bit of what's been going on between America and Russia. You know, we're not actually at war with them, but we're funding the Ukraine. We've been doing all we can to poke the Russian bear for the last few years. And this was a similar thing back then. Instead of actually declaring open war, you would start paying these privateers and they would start helping themselves to whatever was on your ships as they were coming back from the New World. So that plays into this, Max, I think, because there are quite a few, as we'll hear, quite a few instances where he took gold bullion and gold coins and silver coins, and he's actually at the source of lots of legends of buried treasure. But to take a look at his early life, he was the eldest of the 12 sons of Edmund Drake, who was a Protestant farmer. So he didn't come from the aristocracy. He came from a hardworking family. He wasn't born into wealth or anything like that. He was born to a Protestant farmer. Because of religious persecution during the Prayer Book Rebellion in 1549, the Drake family fled from Devon to Kent, and that was a localized rebellion in Cornwall and Devon. Once he was there, Drake's father obtained an appointment to minister to the men in the King's Navy. He was ordained deacon and was made the vicar of Upnor Church on the Medway. Drake's father apprenticed him to his neighbour, the master of a bark used for coastal trade, transporting merchandise to France. And the ship's master was so satisfied with the young Drake's conduct that, being unmarried and childless at his death, he bequeathed the bark to Drake. So at a very young age, he's been given a ship because the ship's master was so impressed with him. Anecdotal evidence indicates that Francis next served in a fairly humble capacity as a seaman on a series of voyages on the ships of John Hawkins between 1560 and 1568. As just a humble sailor, Drake is seldom mentioned by name in any of the records. They carried mainly cloth and manufactured goods, often contraband, that piracy was also a lure. On a trip to Guinea, John Hawkins brought home to England valuable cargoes of gold, ivory, pepper, and an idea. The West African slave trade was officially a Portuguese monopoly, but John Hawkins devised a plan to break into that trade, and in 1562 enlisted the aid of friends and family to finance his venture, and it was a success. Hawkins returned in 1563 a rich man. Hawkins immediately began planning his next trip, gaining both Queen Elizabeth's support in the form of a ship, the Jesus de Lubeck, and the rest of his needed venture capital from a consortium of investors. Drake was 20 years old at the time and not a member of that consortium when he sailed on Hawkins' second voyage, but the crew would have received a share in the profits. Therefore, scholars such as Chris Lane list Drake with Hawkins as one of the first English slave traders. I'll just stop there because he wasn't involved in this. He got a share of the profits, but he wasn't actually involved in taking the slaves. And later on, we'll hear that he freed slaves. He had a slave on his vessel, a freed slave that turned out to be a close friend of his throughout his life. And yet now we're being told he was one of the first English slave traders. And it's not like they were going on to Africa and kidnapping these Africans. What they would have been doing was undercutting the Portuguese. They would have found some way of doing this. Portugal was obviously in alliance with Spain, and this was part of the undermining of the economy of the Spanish and the Portuguese. And he wasn't involved in planning this at all. You could say that the slaves themselves were benefiting from this because they were fed and they were clothed and they were looked after by the English slave traders. It's a scandal, really, that they attack him for this, especially in view of what happened later on. But they claim here that he was one of the first English slave traders. And I don't think you would have read that in information on Sir Francis Drake 5 years ago. I don't think they would have mentioned anything about it. Well, that second run was also a success. However, the Spanish and the Portuguese had become aware of what the English were doing. So they sent their London ambassadors to lodge complaints with Queen Elizabeth. Spain and Portugal were the major seafaring powers of the 16th century, holding established trade monopolies, including the West African slave trade. England was small, relatively poor, and struggling from civil and religious division, and Elizabeth was not yet willing to risk war with Spain, so the Queen instructed Hawkins not to undertake a third trip that year. Hawkins agreed, and then covertly furnished John Lovell with a fleet to do it for him. Drake's presence on earlier voyages has been mostly assumed, but there is firm testimony that Drake was on board one of Lovell's ships for this voyage. In 1566-67, sailing under Captain John Lovell on one of a fleet of ships owned by the Hawkins family, they attacked Portuguese settlements and slave ships on the coast of West Africa and then sailed to the Americas and sold the captured cargoes of enslaved Africans to Spanish plantations. The voyage was largely unsuccessful and more than 90 enslaved Africans were released without payment. When Lovell arrived back in Plymouth in 1567, with these disappointing results, Hawkins' third troublesome voyage, or fourth if Lovell's is included, was planned, and it would be a turning point in Drake's life. So there's two things to pick out here. They took the slaves and everything else because it was an attack on the Spanish economy, basically, but then they sold them to the Spanish plantations. So the people on the plantations, you know, they weren't fussy about where they got their workers from. They didn't care if they got them from the Spanish or the English. They just needed to get workers. And also, they freed 90 of them. So why isn't he referred to as being a great slave emancipator? You know, they just let these 90 enslaved Africans go for free. Anything you want to say on that, Max?
Well, just that in parts of Africa, like the Congo, for example, the slave trade has continued to exist up to very recent times. In particular, the enslavement of the pygmy tribes of the central Congo by the larger, presumably Bantu tribes that occupy most of that area now.
Yeah, I did a narration the other day, which was by one of the officers in Sir Henry Morgan Stanley's crew, and he was recording the African slave trade in the Congo, and this was after it had actually been banned, the Atlantic slave trade, and it was still going on in the Congo, and he was recording the sort of things that went on, and the slaves would be eaten, basically. When their owner died, they would be sacrificed, and they would also be eaten, and they were treated in absolutely appalling ways. And I can imagine that an Englishman, upon seeing that, would have thought, well, surely it would be better for these slaves to be in America, owned by white people, where they'd be looked after, where they wouldn't be sacrificed if their owner dies. They would be set free and given a pension. And you can imagine them looking at it and thinking, well, that would be much better than the situation that they are actually in. So, I don't think they were looking at it thinking, let's be as mean as possible as we can to these people, because Sir Henry Morgan Stanley's crew member is obviously looking at them with compassion, and he's trying to think of ways that this can be stopped. And this was long after we'd actually banned the transatlantic slave trade. The Africans were still engaging in it. It was part of their economy. And I think, it was wrong of them to do, but I can imagine them thinking, well, they're going to be much better off with a white owner, aren't they? And what Drake was doing was taking slaves that had already been purchased, and he was then taking them and then selling them on as booty, along with anything else that was on the ships, ivory, gold, and what have you. Well, one account of the troublesome third voyage has Drake as the captain of Hawkins' ship Judith from the beginning of the voyage, whereas another account places him as a junior officer aboard the Jesus of Lubeck instead. Whitfield says the voyage began badly and it grew progressively worse. The voyage ended in the ill-fated 1568 incident at San Juan de Lua. Storms, Spanish hostility and African resistance, armed conflict and finally a hurricane separated one ship from the fleet to find its own way home and damaged the others, forcing them to find a port where they could make repairs. After arriving in San Juan de Lua, the port of Vera Cruz, the newly appointed Viceroy of New Spain arrived with a fleet of ships. While still negotiating to resupply and repair, Hawkins' ships were attacked by the fleet of Spanish warships, with all but two of the English ships lost. The Jesus de Lubeck was set on fire. Drake escaped, surviving the attack by swimming. The Judith departed, leaving Hawkins and the Minion to limp along alone towards safety. Hundreds of English seamen were abandoned, and Drake's hostility towards the Spanish is said to have started with this incident. And that very fact in itself implies that when Drake was doing the same to the Spaniards, he never would have left the seamen there to drown. They took the crews, they took them prisoner, but they looked after them, they used them as hostages. They would never have just sunk the ships and just left the seamen to drown. And that was the origin of his animosity to the Spaniards. I mean, that continued, not allowing these people to drown, that continued up until the First World War, because I think there was the sinking of the Lusitania or one of those. And that's what really upset the Germans, is that we didn't rescue them afterwards. It's a terrible thing to do. So this was going on back then, and that's what turned Drake against the Spaniards. And it shows that he was chivalrous in his treatment of the hostages that he took, and of the ships that that they, I guess, what is the word you would use? Not hijacked. So it's almost like a highwayman, but at sea, isn't it? Give us all your goods, or we'll scuttle the ship and take you prisoner. Well, details of the aftermath have remained unclear. Hawkins accused Drake of desertion and of stealing the treasure they had accumulated. Drake denied both accusations, asserting that he had distributed all the profits among the crew and that he had believed Hawkins was lost when he left. Other eyewitness accounts exonerate Drake. Whatever the truth about this episode, there is no doubt that it turned Drake's ambitions into a new channel. Thereafter, Spain and all things Spanish became his prey. Slaving and trading voyages no longer interested him. An ignoble ambition, perhaps, but the circumstances of European politics in the 1570s and 1580s, combined with Drake's personal brilliance and tenacious character, served to transform it into a plan of historic importance. Now, they say it's ignoble here, but really, I mean, he's defending his country. And it's before they've actually declared war against Spain, but there is problems with the Spain. The Spanish have been doing things to the British, and this was seen as a way that they could get their own back without actually bothering to declare war. And it does look as if he was telling the truth here. He gave the profits away. Well, in 1572, Drake embarked on his first major independent enterprise. He planned an attack on the Isthmus of Panama, known to the Spanish as Tierra Firma and to the English as the Spanish Main. This was the point at which the silver and gold treasure of Peru had to be landed and then sent overland to the Caribbean Sea, where galleons from Spain would pick it up at the town of Nombre de Dios. Drake left Plymouth on the 24th of May, 1572, with a crew of 73 men in two small vessels, the Pasha, which was 70 tons, and the Swan, which was 25 tons, and the plan was to capture the Nombre de Dios. The most celebrated of Drake's adventures along the Spanish Main was his capture of the Nombre de Dios in March 1573. He raided the waters around Darien, which is in modern Panama, with a crew including many French privateers, including Willem Le Testu, a French buccaneer, and Maroons, enslaved Africans who had escaped from their Spanish slave owners. One of these men was Diego, who under Drake became a free man. Diego was also a capable shipbuilder. Drake tracked the silver train to the nearby port of Nombre de Dios, and after their attack on the richly laden mule train, Drake and his party found that they had captured around 20 tons of silver and gold. They buried much of the treasure, as it was too much for their party to carry, and made off with a fortune in gold. An account of this may have given rise to subsequent stories of pirates and their buried treasure. Wounded, Le Testu was captured and later beheaded. The small band of adventurers dragged as much gold and silver as they could carry back across some 18 miles of jungle-covered mountains to where they had left the raiding boats. When they got to the coast, the boats were gone. Drake and his men, downhearted, exhausted and hungry, had nowhere to go, and the Spanish were not far behind. At this point, he rallied his men, buried the treasure on the beach, and built a raft to sail with two volunteers 10 miles along the surf-lashed coast to where they had left the flagship. When he finally reached its deck, his men were alarmed at his bedraggled appearance, and fearing the worst, they asked him how the raid had gone. Drake could not resist a joke and teased them by looking downhearted. Then he laughed, pulled a necklace of Spanish gold from around his neck and said, "Our voyage is made, lads." And by the 9th of August, 1573, they had returned to Plymouth. And it was during this expedition that Drake climbed a high tree in the central mountains of the Isthmus of Panama and thus became the first Englishman to see the Pacific Ocean. And he remarked as he saw it that he hoped that one day an Englishman would be able to sail it, which he would then do years later as part of his circumnavigation of the world. And when Drake returned to Plymouth after the raids, the government signed a temporary truce with King Philip of Spain. And so the British government was unable to acknowledge Drake's accomplishment officially, but he was considered a hero in England from this time and a pirate in Spain for his raids. So 20 tons of gold and silver, that might tie in with what you were saying there at the beginning, Max, about them collecting all this gold and silver from the mines in Peru. So this wasn't like the Spanish were really industrious and making all this wealth. They were basically taking it from Peru. And
I can't remember where I read it, but it was an account of the Spanish mining precious metal in South America. And I'm glad that the notes that you have show that it was Peru. But the mines that they had in this particular location, there was a particular location where there were the largest seams of precious metal anywhere in the world, and so it was just that the Spanish had got effectively a factory there where they were just melting the raw ore that they dug out of the ground and minting doubloons, I think it was, and these doubloons were then putting chests and loaded aboard ships and sailed off. And this is where, you know, all the sort of like romantic raiding Pirates of the Caribbean type of stories that, you know, are all sort of based upon legends emanating from this of rival nations, privateers and buccaneers and pirates all competing with each other to steal the treasure and get it back to Europe to benefit their home nation.
Yeah, this is where it must have all come from. And I guess after he'd made this raft and made it back to his ship, they must have gone back to the beach there and dug it up and taken it back with them. I mean, it's quite an exciting life to be had back then. There's something negative that he is associated with is a massacre that took place in Ireland, the Rathlin Island Massacre, where 200 defenders and 400 civilians who had surrendered were actually killed. And they tried to use this to put a blot on his record. But he was not actually present at this massacre. He was actually at sea preventing the reinforcements from arriving at the island. It was whoever it was that was on the island that was actually responsible for this, but they tried to link him into that. And that happened after he got back to England after this. And obviously the Queen would have made a lot of money from this, because the monarch made 50% from everything that was taken by these privateers. And if you imagine, England was in a very poor state at that time. The black slaves that were in England were actually better off than the white peasants that were unemployed. So this would have been a big boost to England's coffers to bring back all that silver and gold. We'll get more into that next week, I think, and the circumnavigation. Unless you've got anything else you'd like to add for this week, Max?
No, I think we've set the scene for Sir Francis Drake, and it'll be interesting to talk through the rest of his life next week.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.